It's Monday, September 30, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Just about everyone in the nation is looking to Washington, D.C. today, and that's evidently the way the people in Washington want it. The issue, of course, is a threatened government shutdown that will take place at midnight tonight if the Congress and the White House don't agree on some kind of budgetary compromise. Both sides say they want to compromise, and yet both sides say that they will not compromise their most basic convictions. That's why in Washington today, there's very little expectation that some kind of breakthrough compromise is going to be achieved. We're talking here about a threatened shutdown of the federal government, but we need to note that one of the reasons why this kind of thing can be threatened is that it isn't actually real. At least about 59%, almost 60% of all federal employees are designated as having essential functions, which means they'll continue to work. A federal shutdown doesn't mean that the FBI and the CIA will stop working. It doesn't mean that the Army will stand down. It doesn't mean that air traffic controllers and the TSA will stay home and airports will close. It means that certain designated non-essential functions will come to a halt. Things like the national parks or certain other federal services and institutions. While this is the central event today in Washington, it is, as we've discussed so many times in the past, what the late Librarian of Congress Daniel Boorstin rightly called a pseudo-event. An actual event is an event that will change history, an event that has real issues and real people working towards a real solution. This is not a real event. This is a pseudo-event. It is a politically staged event, and it's staged by both the Democrats and the Republicans, by both conservatives and liberals, because at this point, this kind of drama is evidently preferable to actually achieving some kind of political deal. But even as we note that reality, we also need to note that the possibility for this kind of political drama was built into the Constitution itself. Our founders did want the federal government to be able to accomplish certain functions, but our founders also put into the Constitution a complicated separation of powers, which leads all too often to this kind of impasse. In other words, they wanted the government to have the capacity of being shut down. The alternative to this kind of political arrangement is what you see in Great Britain. It's a parliamentary system where one party is entirely in power and it can never be stopped unless it stops itself. In the United States, we have not only a separation of powers between the executive and the legislative and the judiciary, we also have a separation of parties within the Congress itself. So while you will hear conversation all day about this being evidence that our government doesn't work, on the other hand, it's also an odd kind of evidence that the Constitution does work. You can count on this much, just about every elected politician, starting with President Obama, and the Congress in particular, every party and every political leader is trying to figure out exactly how this is going to go down and how it can go down to their least damage and greatest opportunity. Insofar as the American people are concerned, there's not a whole lot we can do about this except watch and wait. But just about every political actor in this is well aware of a fundamental fact. Most Americans aren't watching or waiting too closely. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, at the end of last week, a judge ruled that that state's ban on legal same-sex marriage amounts to an unconstitutional act against the citizens of New Jersey. As the judge, Mary C. Jacobson, of the State Superior Court in Mercer County, wrote in her decision handed down on Friday, quote, same-sex couples must be allowed to marry in order to obtain equal protection of the law under the New Jersey Constitution, end quote. And yet a closer look at her decision makes very clear that it's not just the New Jersey Constitution that was at stake, but the federal Constitution. And it's also clear that this judge in New Jersey, and remember this is a state court judge, was explicitly citing the decision handed down in June by the United States Supreme Court in the case known as Windsor, in which the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act as an unconstitutional bias against same-sex couples. Here's what makes this particular case so interesting. New Jersey has legal civil unions, and this judge is arguing that until June, those legal civil unions in New Jersey had effectively the same rights as marriage, but no longer, because according to the U.S. Supreme Court, in striking down the DOMA decision, the federal government would then begin to recognize same-sex couples who were legally married as having the same rights and privileges, access to a number of federal benefits that married heterosexual couples had. So as Judge Jacobson ruled, after the June decision by the United States Supreme Court, civil unions were no longer equivalent to marriage in the state of New Jersey. Thus, she said, this was a denial of equal protection to same-sex couples and same-sex citizens in that state. More importantly, as Kate Zernike and Mark Santora of the New York Times observe, this is the first time a court has struck down a state's refusal to legalize same-sex marriage as a direct result of the Supreme Court ruling. And, as they further note, with lawsuits pending in other states, this could predict other successful challenges across the country. This sets up a political drama in the state of New Jersey. New Jersey's Republican governor, Chris Christie, who, by the way, is running for re-election, had argued that the people of New Jersey should decide this question by means of a referendum. He did that after the New Jersey legislature had passed legislation that would have legalized same-sex marriage. He vetoed that and instead said that it would be up to the people. But then the New Jersey legislature refused to allow the legislation to go forward that would have called for the referendum. They also, at this point, have not overridden the governor's veto. Thus, you have a political stalemate in New Jersey. On Friday, the governor said that he would not go back to the legislature. He said, since the legislature refused to allow the people to decide expeditiously, we will let the Supreme Court make this constitutional determination. End quote. As you might expect, the national media were all over this. The editorial board of the New York Times wrote, the basic injustice of allowing civil unions but not same-sex marriage became significantly more egregious when, following the Supreme Court's ruling on same-sex marriage in June, federal agencies like the Internal Revenue Service and the Department of Health and Human Services began rolling out new rules providing for federal benefits for lawfully married same-sex couples. The impact of the Supreme Court decision was very clear, and I hold in my hands the actual decision handed down by the New Jersey judge. She wrote, whereas before Windsor, same-sex couples in New Jersey would have been denied federal benefits regardless of what their relationship was called, these couples are now denied benefits solely as a result of the label placed upon them by the state, end quote. The judge concluded, quote, this unequal treatment requires that New Jersey extend civil marriage to same-sex couples to satisfy the equal protection guarantees of the New Jersey Constitution. She then said same-sex couples must be allowed to marry in order to obtain equal protection of the law under the New Jersey Constitution, end quote. So why is this issue so important? It's not just because of New Jersey. It's because this decision could just as well have been handed down by any state judge in any of the states that do not have legal same-sex marriage. What happened at the end of last week in New Jersey is an absolute pattern for what the advocates of same-sex marriage hope will happen not only in New Jersey, but in your state as well. And you can count on the fact that suits are either in process or in readiness to bring the same issues before a state court in your state. This is precisely why we issued such warnings about the Supreme Court's decisions back in June. The Windsor decision was never just about the Windsor decision. That's why when the United States Supreme Court handed down those decisions on same-sex marriage back in June, we discussed the fact that it's never just about those cases. It is about the long-term legislative and cultural impact of precedents established by the United States Supreme Court. You'll recall that back in June, in his dissent in the Windsor decision, Justice Antonin Scalia said it was just a matter of time before the other shoe fell. Well, the other shoe fell at the end of last week in New Jersey. And if the advocates of same-sex marriage have their way, the shoe is likely to drop soon in your state. In a related story, in Saturday's edition of the New York Times, Tara Siegel-Bernard reports that ExxonMobil, which had drawn criticism for policies related to its gay and lesbian workers, also announced on Friday that it would extend health insurance to married same-sex couples effective August the 1st. That's tomorrow. The reason why this story is important is because it also points back to the Supreme Court's decisions in June as setting the momentum for the change in policy undertaken by this large corporation, an oil giant whose benefits cover 77,000 workers and retirees in the United States. ExxonMobil had been under pressure from gay rights groups for refusing to extend benefits to same-sex couples, and in particular to same-sex legally married couples. But ExxonMobil said that it simply followed the law. But now that the law has changed at the federal level, in the aftermath of those two decisions handed down in June, ExxonMobil has switched sides and has done a 180 on the policy. The absolute proof of the link between the Supreme Court decision and ExxonMobil's decision on Friday was made very clear in a statement released by the corporation. They said, quote, spousal eligibility in our U.S. benefit plans has been and continues to be governed by the federal definition of marriage and spouse, end quote. Next, at the end of last week, another controversy crossed our national attention, and this one demonstrates just how confused the American people and many of their leaders can be about the issue of constitutional rights. As the Associated Press reports, University of Kansas anthropology professors are accusing school officials of violating the constitutional rights of a fellow professor by placing him on leave because of a post on Twitter. Journalism professor David Guth got into hot water for a tweet aimed at the National Rifle Association after the September 16 shootings at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. left 13 dead. The professor's tweet includes some language that can't be repeated on this broadcast, but he also said, "The blood is on the hands of the NRA. Next time, let it be your sons and daughters. Shame on you." As the Associated Press reports, the backlash was swift, with many accusing Guth of wishing death on the children of NRA members. Some Kansas legislative leaders called on the university's chancellor to fire Guth, with a few saying they wouldn't support funding for the university if the professor were not fired. Guth said that he wasn't advocating violence, but just trying to make gun rights advocates look at shootings from the point of view of the victims' families. The professor has been put on leave in order to avoid disrupting classes. The chancellor said, quote, "not because of the nature of the professor's comments, regardless of how controversial they may be," end quote. As the Associated Press concludes, quote, "tenured faculty members in the journalism school have also issued a statement supporting Guth's First Amendment rights to free speech, though they said they disagreed with his statement," end quote. So why the attention to this story? It's about the attention to the First Amendment. We need to note that the First Amendment is likely indeed to protect this kind of speech. What it doesn't protect is the ability of an employee to make this kind of statement and keep his job. There is no constitutional right to employment. There's certainly no constitutional right for an employer to have to keep employing you after you make a statement such as this. But the confusion on the issue wasn't just located in the faculty of the University of Kansas. It appeared in the pages over the weekend of USA Today. Ken Paulson, identified as a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors, president of the First Amendment Center and dean of the College of Mass Communication at Middle Tennessee State University, perpetuated the confusion. He wrote, "It's not just athletes and celebrities who damage their careers with indiscreet tweets. A University of Kansas journalism professor has blown up his career with a tweet after the shootings at the Washington Navy Yard. The tweet was insensitive," said Paulson, "disturbing and dumb, and elicited exactly the kind of reaction you'd expect." Then he writes, "Of course, the rush to fire Guth faces one big obstacle. It is precisely the kind of free speech the First Amendment is intended to protect," end quote. But Mr. Paulson surely knows, after all he's identified here as the dean of the College of Mass Communication at Middle Tennessee State University and as president of the First Amendment Center, he must know that the First Amendment would protect him from going to jail, but it certainly doesn't protect him in terms of keeping his job. And yet, even as Paulson must be fully aware of that, if indeed he's competent to hold his job, he goes on and makes the point as if he doesn't know this. He writes, quote, "Anyone who saw Guth's tweet knows where he stands. He made a provocative statement on a matter of public policy, one that most Americans would be repelled by. But the guarantees of the First Amendment were not intended to protect popular speech. They were intended to prevent punishment of Americans for expressing what the government and others did not want to hear," end quote. But Mr. Paulson surely knows that the Constitution was written in this way to prevent the government from punishing an individual citizen, not to make certain that an employer must keep on employing someone who would make this kind of statement. But then Paulson makes a statement that in a certain, very limited context, would be true, but in this context is both irresponsible and intellectually dishonest. He writes, quote, "The right to express a political opinion is absolute in America. While there are very narrow exceptions to First Amendment protections, they largely involve speech that is inherently criminal, including distributing child pornography, inciting violence, and making a true threat against someone. This was not a threat. The professor was not saying he'd harm someone, and tastelessness is not a crime," end quote. That statement would be true if the context of this article was about some threatened action against this professor by government, but that is not the context of this article. Interestingly, when Paulson comes to the end of his argument, he shifts his vocabulary to something that's more accurate and more honest, but he doesn't acknowledge what he's doing. He ends by writing, "Ensuring academic freedom is critical to the health and vitality of America's campuses. Few would defend a crass tweet like this, but our principles must prevail," end quote. Well, the principle he was citing through about 90% of this article was the First Amendment, but now he switched gears to academic freedom. That is not the same thing, and this dean surely knows that. We should certainly be thankful that we have the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but we should not be thankful about its confusions. We should be thankful that, indeed, we are free from our government being able to arrest us if the government doesn't like our political opinions or statements. But that's very different than saying that employers are constitutionally required to keep employing someone, regardless of what that employee might say, politically or otherwise. That's absolute nonsense, and Ken Paulson surely knows it. If you wonder about that, just ask this question. How long would an editorial writer for USA Today keep his job if he had made a similar comment in a similar tweet? Finally, a look at another story that crossed the wires over the weekend indicating our progressive loss of sanity in this culture. And in this case, the loss of sanity is demonstrated in the fact that we seem unable to tell real issues from false ones and big issues from small ones. The story comes from Virginia Beach, Virginia, where a Virginia middle school has handed down long-term suspensions to two 13-year-old boys who were found guilty of playing with airsoft guns in one boy's yard before school. The story is broken by WAVY, the NBC affiliate in Hampton Roads, Virginia. As that news affiliate demonstrated, the two 13-year-old boys never went to the bus stop. They instead fired the airsoft guns while on one of the boys' private property. In other words, in the boy's front yard before school. The boy's father, Tim Clark, told WAVY what happened next lacks all common sense. The children were suspended for possession, handling, and use of a firearm. Of course, as many have pointed out, the word fire in firearm implies gunpowder, which is notably absent from an airsoft pistol. Also absent in this story was any harm or any threat of harm to any human being. But the school handed down two long-term suspensions, which means basically expulsion for the year. And the principal of the school put out a statement. He said this, "As the principal of Larkspur Middle School, I am responsible for the safety of students and will take all appropriate actions to ensure that the students using the pellet guns are appropriately disciplined and held responsible for their conduct. It is my sincere hope they will learn important life lessons, the most important being that there will be consequences when they do things that can result in harm to another person. Given the opportunity, teachers, administrators, and our entire community should always be willing to step forward to protect one another. This was a dangerous situation that involved the intervention of law enforcement, the Office of Safety and Loss Control, and our school administration. I trust that parents and the public will support our actions, which are taken with safety in mind." End quote. Well, that's where you have to scratch your head and wonder, what was the danger and who was harmed? Keep in mind that here you have two 13-year-old boys who are playing with toys. Toys provided for them by their parents. Toys are being played in the front yard of one of the boys. These were airsoft pistols that are recognized as toys by virtually everyone until the principal of the school defines them as firearms. According to the news reports, the boys were pretending that they were protecting their neighborhood from zombies, and in the course of this protective activity, they shot those dangerous airsoft pistols at each other and at least one other student who was passing by. But that's where the story gets really interesting, because no student reported being harmed or threatened in any way. Instead, there was a call made by a mom in the area, a neighbor who was watching this take place, even as, she acknowledged, her kids were involved to some extent. In her call, she said, quote, "This is not a real one, but it makes people uncomfortable. I know that it makes me uncomfortable as a mom to see a boy pointing a gun," end quote. So one mom being concerned leads to two boys being indefinitely suspended because of this activity that apparently harmed no one. We need to acknowledge that the schools and the society at large face very real problems with violence and with weapons. They face very real problems with behavior. But what we're looking at here are two boys playing in the front yard of one of the boys, using toys that no one claims with any seriousness represented dangerous weapons. But they're now out of school, and the school appears to be hardening its position. Well, as many people have acknowledged in terms of looking at this story, this is not only an example of governmental overreach, it's not only an example of the kind of insanity that you find with these zero-tolerance policies that can't tell the difference between a real threat and an airsoft gun, policies that can't distinguish between what would take place at school and in one boy's front yard. But it's really unlikely that the students are going to get these big lessons or even see these big issues. Instead, these boys are likely to think that they got into trouble simply by being boys. And at least for some people in our society, that's actually the reason they were in trouble. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.